Good afternoon. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. The rise of one-party rule in the states. Craig Gilbert is our guest for this hour, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Also joining us, Seth Maskett, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver. I think Craig is one of the best political journalists in the country, and he wrote yet another fascinating piece in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If you didn't see it, it is on our Facebook page, which is about a striking new landscape in state politics. I think that these are amazing statistics. States with one-party rule have soared from 19 10 years ago to 37 today. The number of states with divided government, 12 at its lowest level in 60 years, and only three states have divided legislatures. Half the states now have veto-proof legislative majorities for one side. In his article, Craig asks, is this trend toward one-party rule something to celebrate or be nervous about? Why has it happened? And will it turn out to be a blip or a sea change in American politics? We'll be welcoming your phone calls. He also spent a good deal of time at the National Governors Conference held in Milwaukee last weekend and spoke with a lot of the nation's governors about these very questions. And obviously, they had different perspectives. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Craig, a pleasure to see you again. Hello.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And Professor Seth Maskett, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. A striking new landscape, you call it, in state politics. Holy Toledo, is it ever striking, isn't it?
Yeah, I was sort of oblivious to this change until recently. And it is a big change. I mean, we don't know whether it's kind of cyclical or whether it will last a long time or not. But it is a pretty sudden new reality in state politics where one-party rule is now the norm, and not too long ago it was more the exception than the norm, and divided government was the norm. And and it's interesting to sort of think about why this has happened and also obviously what it means for politics and policymaking.
Mm-hmm. And let's start with what it means for politics, because if you're in a state that's all democratically ruled or all Republican ruled, the kinds of policies that you're going to follow, Professor Maskett, are extraordinarily different, aren't they?
That's correct. Yeah, if you're living in a state with divided rule, you know, by definition, any legislation that comes out of that state has to be bipartisan. Whereas now you have a lot more states that are under unified rule, and you can have Democrats producing very liberal legislation or Republicans producing very conservative legislation. And, yeah, that really will change the character of a state very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And, Craig, what kind of legislation have you noticed from Republican states, from Democratic states? What are the agendas?
Yeah, I think there's a sense among people that have watched this more closely than I have that we've had this sort of burst of activity, very activist legislating on both sides. There's more on the Republican side for one reason, because Republicans control more states than Democrats do, and it's also been somewhat dramatic on the Republican side just because of the impact of the Tea Party movement on the party and a more activist party than we saw 10 or 20 years ago. So it's been pretty dramatic. I mean, you know, we're here in Wisconsin where in the last couple of years we've seen big things on unions, big moves against unions, legislation now on abortion, restricting abortion. In some states we're seeing a loosening up of gun restrictions. Again, these are all on the conservative side. Certainly tax cuts and in some cases, you know, tax cuts aimed at the top of the income scale or marginal rates. So on the Democratic side, you know, same-sex marriage, universal background checks in some states. In Minnesota, I started thinking about this seriously a month or two ago when I was looking at what was happening in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And
mm-hmm.
there it's dramatic because the states are neighbors and because they tend to vote the same way in presidential elections. But there you have a newly unified Democratic state government as of the 2012 election in Minnesota and, of course, a unified Republican government in Wisconsin. And just you go down the line, whether it's unions, abortion, guns, taxes, education, implementing the national health care law, just two states veering off in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm. You ask whether or not there could be a risk of overreach and backlash, especially in the competitive battleground states that have a track record of voting for candidates in both parties. Let's ask Seth if there will be any backlash and whether or not you agree there may be a risk of overreach and backlash. Seth?
Well, one of the things with the states moving in these different directions is that there's less of a chance of backlash than there used to be. You have, in some ways, voters sorting themselves a little bit into fairly red states and fairly blue states, and just means that a very Republican state can advance very conservative legislation and not face the kind of backlash at the next polls than there used to be. You might see sort of a backlash forming at the federal level, either one way or the other. If the economy takes a downturn and people turn against Democrats, or if they feel there's been too much Republican overreach, that can end up filtering down to the state level. But generally, there's not as much of a backlash at the state level.
What about in states like Wisconsin that you could say are probably purple states or have been? Craig?
Well, I agree. I do think, though, there are some states, I think there's eight states or eight or nine, maybe nine states where we've got Republican governors who were elected in 2010 in states that Obama won twice now. So I think there's a little bit more risk of overreach and backlash in those states where you have less of a fit between the governing agenda and the kind of electorate in those states, because these are states that are obviously battleground states. They're voting Democratic, at least in recent elections at the presidential level, yet where they have unified Republican control, the state government is moving, not in every case, but in many cases, in a pretty aggressive way in a conservative direction. So, again, the backlash, it's probably a state-by-state, a case-by-case basis in these states. In some cases, you've got redistricting effects where the legislature is insulated, just like the U.S. House is to some degree. And governors of, some who are secure and some who are quite vulnerable.
Could you address the redistricting issue, Seth, and how that has secured seats perhaps for the foreseeable future for whatever party is in control?
Well, redistricting tends to work in a couple of different ways, and it kind of depends what the parties in power are trying to do with it. In some states, you'll see kind of a unified majority party trying to protect its lead by getting even more seats. And when they do that, by the nature of that type of redistricting, they're actually making more districts more competitive. They're actually getting more districts that there's going to be some fight over, and that doesn't necessarily protect incumbents all that much. In other states, you'll see more of an incumbent protection type of redistricting, where basically everyone is trying to make every seat safe, and that just tends to undermine competition and, if anything, move things in a slightly more polarized direction.
Do states do redistricting in wildly different ways, Craig?
Well, they do. I mean, most states. There's a relative handful of states that try to do it in a nonpartisan way. Iowa is the classic example, and they tend to have more competitive districts, even though it's a small state. So there's not a lot of cases there. But most states, it's a partisan process, and it depends on whether in the year of the census. One party has managed to seize the levers of government or not. And Wisconsin obviously is one case where it was, and not just Wisconsin, but nationally, 2010 was an historic Republican surge. And so it certainly positioned the party well in a lot of states, not in all states. But Wisconsin, I think, is one of those cases where the redistricting plan was both created less competition and more of a partisan tilt. I mean, it was a pretty amazing plan. It's not easy to do both those things at once, but I've looked at that plan really closely, and we do have, as a result, we have fewer competitive districts, but we also have many more Republican districts, and it makes it very difficult for, in this case, the out party, the Democrats, to get that back, because they have to win a whole bunch of seats that are, that are distinctly Republican seats.
Mm-hmm. You asked the question, and let me have you answer it, and then Seth, would you answer it as well? Is this trend toward one-party rule something to celebrate or be nervous about? Craig, how do you answer your own question?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I think, you know, it's a moving target in the sense that it's not just it's not just a matter of whether we have one party rule or not. It's also a matter of the composition of the parties and the distance between the two parties. So, you know, one party rule 20 years ago might have meant something differently than one party rule today. I think one reason why we're seeing all this activist legislating is it's the combination of one party rule with the parties we have today, which are more polarized and which are, as Seth put it when I talked to him, more programmatic. I mean, they're so, you know, it may be that divided government 20 years ago was a formula for getting bipartisan things done. I mean, you think back to this era of Republican, a lot of Republican governors like Tommy Thompson, George Pataki, a lot of Republican governors in purple to bluish states, Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, New Jersey, and New York. And they were able to carve out national reputations for themselves by getting stuff done often with a legislature of the other party. Whether you could even do that today is, I think, an open question, given the nature of the differences between the parties.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the question, Seth, or should I say it again? Is it
whether this is something to celebrate or not?
Or be nervous about, right?
In some ways, this is really something to celebrate. So, you know, just a few decades ago, or even more recently, it didn't necessarily matter which party you voted for. I mean, it maybe mattered to you personally, but you were probably going to get similar results no matter what happened. Today, these results really matter. If you vote for a Republican government and put one in office, you're going to get very conservative results out of them. Mm-hmm. And if you vote for Democrats, you're going to get very liberal results. All this means that elections really matter now in a way that they didn't just a few years ago. And we're starting to see the consequences of that. It's also a nice, in some ways, it's a nice antidote to what we so often see at the federal level, which is just really a lot of gridlock. We're having quite the opposite of gridlock in a lot of our state governments right now.
Mm-hmm. You spoke to, at the governor's conference, several governors who had very different things to say about whether or not one-party rule is a good thing or a bad thing. Start with the governor of Colorado.
Well, John Hickenlooper, who's a pretty, you know, he was not a career politician. He's an interesting guy. He's a Democrat. His state has done some things, attention-getting things recently in terms of, like, universal background checks was maybe the most controversial thing they did, even though that obviously has a lot of public support as well. But, you know, it was sort of a cautionary note from a cautionary answer on his part that it's not always the best thing, that sometimes it's good to force policymakers to find common ground across the aisle. Governor Walker had a different answer, and this was actually closer to Seth's answer, which is that, you know, hey, what's wrong with putting one party in charge and let's see what they can do? And then people can vote that up or vote that down. I think you do get into some issues where there is always the potential abuse of power. Governor McCrory of North Carolina made that point. Another state that's gotten a lot of attention because of activist legislation on the conservative in a conservative direction recently. It's the first time Republicans have had unified control of North Carolina since the 19th century.
Woo!
And I think he's got a legislature that, even though he's a pretty conservative guy, is, if anything, further to the right than he is. And he was sort of presenting himself as somebody who had acted as a check on his own Republican legislature to some degree. I don't follow North Carolina politics closely enough to know how true that is. But he did say, you know, as long as the party in power doesn't abuse its power and doesn't get too arrogant or too corrupt. And I think that is a danger. I mean, we've seen in some states, when a party seizes power, it not only leaves its imprint on public policy, but it also sometimes tries to change the rules of the road and seize political advantage in a way that might perpetuate its power beyond just implementing, public policy that is consistent with their political values.
And some of the public policy is now facing legal challenges, which is keeping the public policy from moving forward, right?
That's true. And you do get, you know, when you have dramatic policy being made, you do get dramatic, sometimes you get upheaval. And I'm not saying that's not always a bad thing, but it comes with the territory, I mm-hmm. think. And we've seen that in some states, too.
When you look at the two parties' philosophy, Seth, would you say that we're at a time, as you look at this historically, where Republicans are more conservative than they ever have been and Democrats are more liberal?
Yes, you can see a lot of evidence of that, actually, both at the congressional level and for most of the state legislatures, that both parties have been, in many ways, weeding out their moderates over the last few decades. You probably see more of that going on the Republican side, particularly nationally in recent years. But in general, yeah, the type of people that Democrats are electing are more liberal than they used to be. The type of people that Republicans are electing are more conservative than they used to be.
Is that going to change?
If anything, we're probably going to move more in that direction.
Really?
for the near future. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that's kind of the historical norm in this country, of very divided parties. The real anomaly there, the weird time, was shortly after World War II, from roughly the 1950s to the 1980s, when you had this unusual system where you had the most conservative region of the country, the South, was all Democratic due to historical reasons, and that has mostly sorted itself out now, where we're moving back toward the polarization we had 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Craig?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think part of the trend toward one party rule is this kind of regional sorting, where now you have Democrats more dominant than ever, for example, in the Northeast, which has still, has a long recent history of Republican governors. We still have one in Chris Christie now, but fewer than there used to be. And so Republicans becoming less able to get elected in these states in the Northeast, and obviously the reverse in the South, which is a bigger region, and it's more dramatic because of so when one region kind of becomes a one-party region, it's going to have a pretty dramatic impact on these overall numbers. And so that's one reason why I think some of this may be enduring as opposed to just cyclical.
Hmm. Well, let me ask what may be a ridiculous question, but I'm wondering if things have reached the point, particularly when you look at certain populations like the gay, lesbian population in this country, where people may choose where to live on the basis of what the policies are in a certain state.
Well, there was a book called The Big Sort written on that very subject, and I think it, from my point of view, it's definitely happening to some degree in some places. I mean, but I don't think it's uniform. I don't think it's necessarily happening everywhere. But I think, and Seth, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think there has been some sort of sorting at the state level where a little bit of polarization in terms of red and blue states, and to some degree at the county level too. So whether that's how much of that is driven by decisions individual people make about where to live, and how much of it is just some other kind of dynamic that's occurring in areas that are dominated by one party, I'm not sure.
Seth, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. We've seen some evidence over the last few decades of people sorting themselves into different states, people sorting themselves into different counties, even where people who liberals will tend to want to live in the same situation that other liberals do. Conservatives will tend to live near other conservatives, not necessarily because they're seeking out people who think the same way politically as they do, but simply because increasingly politics and lifestyle kind of have an interaction. Where if you like living in an urban area with lots of ethnic restaurants and a walkable neighborhood, you tend to be liberal, and other people who seek that also tend to be liberal. And so people have just been sorting themselves along those lines. But I think increasingly, we're starting to see that political decisions are fitting into that as well, particularly if you're gay or lesbian and you want to, and you're thinking about marriage or parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Latino and are concerned about whether you might be harassed as an undocumented immigrant, suddenly the state's politics really matter in your personal life in a way that they didn't used to.
Right. I would think that would be the case. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our conversation this hour prompted by an article, yet another article, Craig Gilbert wrote. It's in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and it is on the rise of one-party rule in America, and it is quite significant what's going on. It's a striking new landscape, as he said, as in state politics. What do you think about what's going on and why it's going on? Do you imagine it will change? Do you think about what the policies are in certain states when you decide where you're going to live, or is that too far-fetched? How would you answer the question that Craig asks, which is interesting? Is this trend toward one-party rule something to celebrate or be nervous about? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Our guests, to repeat, Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Seth Maskett, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver, and we go to Ralph in Little Suamico for our first call. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I think you addressed some of these things while I was on hold, but I'll just reiterate it and enforce it, I guess, or disagree. But I think that the one-party rule is a good thing, and that's regardless of whether it's Democrat or Republican. And the main reason is because that's how you get things done. Whenever you have divided government, nothing gets done. And I think, like someone else had mentioned earlier, if after 4 years you feel like the job is not a good job, they're not doing a good job, then you vote against that party. So I think it holds them responsible, too, because they can't say, well, I couldn't do anything because the other party wouldn't go along with me. They mm-hmm. disagreed with me.
Thanks, Ralph, for the call. Seth?
Well, I think recent history bears that out. I mean, just thinking, for example, recently in Colorado, where I am, in the last legislative session, it was a split control. Democrats had the Senate, Republicans had the House. There were bills introduced about gun control. There were bills introduced about civil unions, and neither of them went anywhere. Then suddenly Democrats take over, and you have unified control with a Democratic governor, and all these things are getting passed into law. Now, you can disagree with those particular policies, but they are definitely being passed. They're being signed into law by the governor. But you also see, the potential for some backlash there. Governor Hickenlooper's approval ratings have taken a little bit of a hit recently. Maybe there will be some sort of backlash in the next election. It's hard to say at this point, but we're already seeing some recall efforts from some of these state legislators who voted for these things. So, but, yeah, you do see productivity for all that's good and bad about that.
Well, certainly there have been times, haven't there, Craig, when you've had one party control the gubernatorial aspect, and then you've had Democrats one or both houses of the legislative assembly, and something has gotten done, right?
Well, certainly in the past, that's been true. You just wonder whether it's less true today. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Washington, where it's paralyzing, really. I mean, there's just sort of – there's no capacity, really – to act across the aisle in Congress because of the distance between the parties now. And I don't know if there are any great examples right now at the state level of that being overcome, but I think it's certainly I think it probably bolsters Seth's argument when you look at how difficult it is for the two parties to agree on anything anywhere these days.
Well, and everybody's mad about it. So doesn't the public have something to say about this? You better do something. We elected you, and they're not doing a thing.
Yeah, and the public, it's not like the public sort of most voters go out there and say, I'm voting for divided government. I mean, divided
right.
government is usually the product of, one party, winning one branch of government by a little bit and the other party winning the other branch by a little bit. Most people are voting, one way for everything on both sides. But divided government is sort of the byproduct of all those individual decisions. So I don't think people are necessarily choosing I don't think too many people are necessarily choosing divided government, but they certainly have the option now at the state level, if they don't like it, to choose something else.
Yeah. Gino and DePere, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a while. We're Wisconsin, in the presidential elections, have pretty much have gone Democratic, you know, going for Barack both times. But in the off presidential elections, they've gone Republican. And it seems like the Republicans have been really good at motivating their base. You know, you have the two Wisconsin or Milwaukee AM channels that are really good at demonizing liberals and Democrats. And then you have all these little religious stations spread all around the state that broadcast out of, I think it's Washington, D.C., that they do exactly the same thing. You know, it's liberals are killing babies, they're gun controlling, all this stuff, and they're motivating their base, whereas the Democrats only seem to be getting out when they have a president that they can elect. I was wondering what your opinion on that theory is.
Craig.
Yeah, I mean, one of the wrinkles here is that we are in this, at least in Wisconsin, I think in some other states too, in this weird world where one party has the upper hand at the presidential level and the other party has the upper hand in the midterm elections. And it's sort of like it's very pronounced in Wisconsin because it's not just one party has the upper hand. It's that Republicans seem almost incapable of winning at the presidential level these days in Wisconsin, and Democrats seem almost incapable of winning at the state level in terms of the midterm elections. Very different electorates, obviously, and a smaller electorate, not a tiny electorate, but a smaller electorate in the midterms in Wisconsin, and an electorate generally that's more favorable to Republicans because it's a little older and a little whiter and a little more conservative. And of course, in presidential years, when you get a bigger electorate, it's been very hard for Republicans to overcome that big Democratic base vote that you get out of, you know, these you know, out of Madison and Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Seth, should we look at the role of media, particularly talk radio, conservative talk radio, in getting out a vote?
That probably plays some sort of a role. I mean, it's just in general, as Craig points out, there's you know, in a non-presidential election, there's going to be lower turnout, and part of that is that it just, you know, those elections simply get less attention. They get you know, the media will pay less attention to them. And when you have a lower turnout contest, that tends to favor Republicans a little bit more because their constituency
vote.
Tends to mm-hmm. be yeah they always have or at least for a while have had a they've been more likely to turn out to vote. They tend to be a little whiter, a little wealthier, a little older. You also have, you know, simultaneously here the other trend going on is that in midterm elections there's usually a little bit of a backlash against whoever the president's party is. And so you've got a Democrat in the White House. So when they're not up, when it's a midterm election, anyone who's angry at the president is going to show up and for the midterm elections. And so you'll tend to see the out party doing a little better in those races.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't imagine they would do you know, that Republicans will do as well in 2014 as they did in 2010, but that'll still probably be, you know, a slight Republican bias in that electorate.
Let's look at those states where there have been very conservative governors who have won, particularly states like Wisconsin, and maybe there are others that you can talk about. But it seems to me is almost as though the Democrats have cowered in this state as a result of one-party rule. And you look at who might be a possible candidate to run in 2014 against the current governor, Scott Walker. I don't see anybody. I don't see the Democrats really getting together to promote anybody. Are they nervous, or they think they just can't possibly win? And is this true in other states?
I don't think it's true in other states. I think the Democrats will have a candidate, and they're looking at some people now. I think it's, but I don't think there's any question but that the effect of the failed recall was to not only raise Governor Walker's stature, but also ensure that he would be financially well-funded for a long time to come. And it was demoralizing for Democrats. And plus, he, you know, he sort of got that battle out of the way, that that battle that followed the fight over unions and the fight over the budget. So it was a pretty unambiguous boon to Governor Walker, his ability to survive, the fact that there was a recall and the fact that he was able to survive it. It doesn't mean that he's guaranteed to win re-election. When you look at the sort of fundamentals in the state, you know, obviously a competitive state, as we've discussed. Governor Walker's numbers aren't spectacular. I mean, they're more positive than negative, but he's still around 50% approval. He's not a lock from that point of view. And the state has some economic issues it has to work through, which depending on how those job trends play out might be more or less favorable to Governor Walker as well. But I think in a lot of these other states that were Obama states where there are Republican governors, I think Democrats will have pretty vigorous challenges. And probably the four most vulnerable Republican incumbent governors in the country in terms of the 2014 elections are in these states. I mean, I would say Michigan, Florida, Maine, Pennsylvania, those four states, mm-hmm. Obama states, have Republican governors right now who on paper are beatable.
Hmm. Let's go to Keith in Leona. Hi, Keith.
Good afternoon. Thank you. This may be just a little bit off topic, but I think it's worth talking about. You may have seen the op-ed in the New York Times yesterday that suggested that Republicans increasingly are becoming the party of white voters, regardless of socioeconomic status, and Democrats being the party of non-white voters, regardless of socioeconomic status. And I wondered how that figures into this. The op-ed piece suggested that this was a pretty scary situation where our politics becomes even more polarized racially as well as, or instead of, a socioeconomic polarization.
Seth.
I think there is some evidence to support that. I don't know how much that will hold up when, say, you know, you don't have an African-American Democratic presidential candidate going against a white Republican presidential candidate. But, you know, all the evidence we have so far suggests that, like many other demographic features, the electorate seems to be dividing along racial lines. With whites increasingly voting Republican, non-whites increasingly voting Democratic. In the same way that sexual identity is polarizing, and income is somewhat polarizing. Yeah, I think we're seeing race polarizing in a way that it hasn't in a while.
Want to comment, Craig?
Yeah, I guess one thing I would just suggest the caller keep in mind is that some of these patterns look quite different in one state compared to another. And certainly if you look at the white vote in the South, it's extremely dramatic in terms of how Republican it is. But if you look at the white vote in the upper Midwest or the Northeast or the West Coast, it's Democrats are more than competitive. And so, I mean, one of the staggering things about the 08 election was looking at the exit polls and the difference between white voters from state to state, where, for example, Barack Obama got something like 10% of the white vote in Alabama.
Amazing.
And he got over 50% in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Iowa, states that are, you know, pretty white states, at least in the case of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, yet white voters are much more sort of divided, evenly divided between the parties than they are in the South. So the those numbers look a lot different from one region to another.
So what's that all about?
Well, I think it's there's probably some racial factors there, different attitudes about race around the country. It's also just ideology. I mean, you've got a more conservative, you know, some regions of the country are a lot more conservative than other regions of the country. But when you see the variation from one state to another is usually the byproduct of two things. It's the kind of ethnic and racial and demographic composition of the state, and it's also the difference between white voters in one state and white voters in another state. And the differences are really dramatic in some cases.
Yeah, that's a fairly profound thing you just said. It's a fairly profound thing about what's going on, isn't it?
Well,
considering the fact that we're becoming less and less white, too,
yeah,
as a country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keith, thank you very much for your interesting call. Barbara in Waupaca, hi.
Hi. I have two quick things to say. One is for when one party is ruling, I think it
results tends to result, and more recently, in pendulum swings, and that doesn't necessarily institute good government or result in permanent improvement in government. And it seems that one party has acted like they have a mandate whenever they've gotten the whole, you know, both houses and the governor's mansion, and there's always a very large minority, so it's really it's not what it necessarily looks like. But the thing that I think is affecting politics right now, especially for me, is the language and the attitude, how that makes a difference. And they're constantly referring to fighting. They're going to fight for principles. They're fighting for their, you know, the middle class or whatever. And I just would really like to see people working together. And I really feel that if people said we need to work on this issue, we need to work together, that we would be able to get more done. Fighting implies an automatic chip on the shoulder with any conversation and isn't real productive.
Seth.
I think the caller makes an excellent point. Can she restate her first point on that? Was that pendulum swing? That's right. I think she makes an excellent point that we do see, particularly in more moderate states like Wisconsin, like Colorado, you do have the potential for big swings in policy. When a different government takes over, you can have a government moving very much in one direction, and then another party comes in and moves things in the other direction. And, you could see that as a good thing or a bad thing. On the good side, yes, people are getting the policies they're voting for, but it also does make for a lot less certainty, a lot less consistency, and some people find that unsettling. With regards to the language people use, well, for better or for worse, we've been using very combative military-style language in our politics for a long time now. I don't know that that's going to change anytime soon, but I'm assuming most candidates and politicians do this sort of thing, probably because they've got some evidence that voters respond to it, that people are more likely to rally to their side when they talk about, when they use words like attack rather than work. I'm not sure that we'll see a change in that anytime soon.
Craig, you wrote in your piece, you talked about a reduction in ticket splitting by voters that was most notable in the election surge of 2010. I can remember, and I'm sure everybody listening can too, so many people saying, I don't vote for party, I vote for the person I always have. Obviously, that is becoming much less frequent. Has the party been advertising that voting for the party is a good thing, or how has that happened? That's a dramatic shift.
Actually, it's, one of the legislation that we've seen since the 2010 election is they've eliminated straight ticket voting. The ability to cast a single straight party vote in Wisconsin. So that would, in theory, make it harder to vote for a straight ticket. But again, we saw in 2012 really very little ticket splitting. And I know I've talked to – Seth has talked about this in the past, is that it's – one thing that's going on is that when voters are presented very stark choices, when you have different very big differences between the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, in other words, not – a slightly conservative moderate against a slightly liberal moderate, then you're probably going to see less ticket splitting because people are, the same voter is not necessarily going to vote for a hardcore conservative for Senate and a hardcore liberal for governor or for president. And that may be also feeding into the decline in ticket splitting. I know that in Wisconsin, that's definitely been the trend in terms of with less ticket splitting. You've also seen these races become almost cookie cutter images of each other, where not only the outcomes are very similar, not only at the state level, but down to the regional and county level in terms of a Senate race and a governor's race that are on the same ballot.
Mm-hmm. Would there have been a number of people in Wisconsin who have had to have voted for both Scott Walker and Tammy Baldwin?
There would have been some, because we know that there were some that voted for Scott Walker and Barack Obama. Again, different electorates, different elections. One was in June, one was in November. But we know from the exit polls and we know from polling that there was some subset of voters, maybe on the order of 8 or 9 or 10% of the electorate, that approved of and or voted for both Scott Walker and Barack Obama.
How do you explain that?
Well, I think part of it is the recall was a special case where some people, I think Scott Walker did get the votes of some people who weren't necessarily hardcore Republicans but didn't like the recall process. Mm-hmm. So that's one way of explaining it. They're both incumbents, and so maybe people were casting similar judgments about the economy in that sense. But it just goes to show you that that kind of voting is not dead, and it still does matter. I mean, it still does matter in these elections. We've seen, and we get used to thinking. I'm about to do a fellowship at the Marquette Law School, or I've started one where I'm doing a research project on polarization and focused on Milwaukee and this part of the state, which is so ultra polarized in terms of these partisan enclaves in the city and in the suburbs. But you go to other parts of the state. And there were massive swings between the gubernatorial election and the presidential election. And so that's still there.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guests this hour are talking about the striking new political landscape. Craig Gilbert wrote a piece that's on our Facebook page in case you missed it, or on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel site, Sunday's front page story. Recent elections producing explosion in the number of states like Wisconsin, where the same party controls the governor's office and both legislative chambers. States with one-party rule, only 19 a decade ago, 37 today. What does that all mean is what we're talking about with Craig and with Seth Maskett, who's associate professor of political science at the University of Denver. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation in the remaining 10 minutes, we'd like to hear from you, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. A couple lines are open as we continue talking about the rise of one-party rule in America. Roseanne in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I have really, well, more than two issues, but two things that concern me greatly. One is the role of big money, especially in states where, you know, like Wisconsin, where the unions have been pretty much decimated and don't have that much money to spend on ads, and the effect of these ads on the voting public, who sometimes don't bother to check the accuracy of these ads. But the other issue that I'm concerned about, and I'm wondering the relationship between that and, you know, the ease with which one party can gain control in a state. But the other issue I'm concerned about is what role can the federal government play in ensuring that redistricting in these states can be forced to be nonpartisan so that we don't have some of these manipulations.
Seth, let's start with you. The amount of money is phenomenal, isn't it?
We have seen a dramatic increase in the amount of money being spent. I suppose in some ways the good news for the caller is that it's actually hard to find an enormous effect of it. The campaign money, it looks like, has much less of an effect than we used to think it did. Just to use Governor Walker's two elections as an example, when he was first elected, if I'm not mistaken on this, Craig can check me on this, I think he outspent his opponent about 2-1. And then during the recall election, I think he outspent his opponent by about 7-1. And almost the exact same percentage for him in both elections. Now, obviously, they were very different sorts of elections, but what we've seen in a number of different elections, when you compare basically the same people running against each other for the same office, sometimes one will vastly outspend the other. Sometimes they'll have very similar amounts of spending, and you don't actually see a big change in the vote as a result.
Why are we just tuning them out?
Well, it's, for one thing, it's actually fairly hard to change a lot of voters' minds with advertisements. You tend to see, you know, most voters are actually already very loyal to one party or the other. So you can encourage them to vote, but you generally have a hard time changing their minds. There are some voters who are available to have their mind changed, but they are somewhat fickle about these things. They will see an ad, and we actually have some evidence that, you know, you with a massive spending blitz, you can actually change a voter's mind, but that the effect of that ad will be gone within a day or two.
Hmm.
So a lot of that spending that goes on in the weeks and months before an election often in many ways just seems wasted.
Well, I hope everybody in political advertising just heard you, and we can eliminate poverty in the United States.
I mean, one thing I'd add to that is it does matter, you know, how well-known the candidates are and how entrenched a public opinion is about a candidate. Certainly in the case of Governor Walker, you know, that had been such a polarizing period that so many people had their minds made up about him that his ads and the other side's ads weren't going to move a lot of minds. Just like in presidential elections, people tend to be entrenched because they have set opinions. But in, when you get down to elections where lower profile elections, the money can have a pretty big impact. And even in a race like a Senate race, we saw one example in 2012 where Governor Thompson, who had won a very bruising Republican primary in August of 2012, had no money for about a month, and Tammy Baldwin came in and kind of blew him out of the water in terms of spending, and it correlated with a big turnaround in the race in terms of the polling, where she surged ahead of him and maintained that lead throughout the rest of the race. So depending on the circumstance, money can make a difference, but it doesn't always make a difference for sure.
Has Governor Walker accumulated a great deal of money for reelection?
He has a war chest. I don't know how big it is, but I think there's a pretty universal expectation that he's going to outspend his opponent. They'll have lots of money. The other way that money can sometimes matter, too, is it just scares people away from challenging incumbents they don't think that they can compete financially with a well-funded incumbent. Sometimes it just influences the decisions people make whether to run or not.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, thanks, Roseanne, very much for your call. Eric in Madison, hi.
Hello. I wanted to ask how much this is being enabled or enhanced by the fact that district-based elections and whatnot for the legislature really completely remove any influence third-party voters have, the 5 or 10% or whatever of people who would want a third-party representative in the legislature. They are not getting that 5 or 10% of the legislature. And as such, their power is going to one of the two parties in control. Is that really helping lead to single-party control at all? Or, yeah.
Okay, Seth.
I want to make sure I understand the question. Is it that we just, I mean, we really haven't had for quite some time that much of a presence of third-party candidates winning congressional or state legislative elections. So is the concern that single party dominance is becoming more of an issue because of a decline in third party votes?
Actually, I was sort of more referencing the whole bit where there never really was any power because a third party can never win a single district. Would a system that allowed the 5 or 10% of people spread out across the state to get a power in the legislature, would that reduce single party control at all?
Oh, I see. This is basically, you know, single party plurality elections is basically the system we have throughout the United States. It is possible, you know, if we look to other democracies to see other systems that are available where you could have some sort of plurality voting system where essentially people vote the party rather than they literally just check a box for a party rather than checking a box for a candidate to win a district. And then you might see, a party with winning just 10% of the vote, but also winning 10% of the legislative seats. And those are situations where, it's actually harder for one single party to win an outright majority of a legislature, and you tend to have to see some sort of compromises occur to get a governing majority coalition.
Seth, thank you. We are out of time. Seth Maskett, Associate Professor of Political Science, University of Denver. Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So you're not going to be writing for a while?
No, I'll be working on this project, and
okay.
At the end of which I'll have a lot.
All right. But it doesn't preclude you from doing talk shows.
Not at all.
All right. Good. We'll see you soon. Thank you. Craig Gilbert with us as well. The article that we based our talk show on, actually, is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program, and the theme music. How about that? We were a holdup, but here we are. We got theme music. Thanks to Mark Thiel. We'll have hour two in a moment.